Hello, everyone. Good afternoon, good evening almost. Not quite good afternoon. CALP 2011. This is a You Changed My Life panel. Pause for dramatic effect. No oohs and ahs, nothing. I hope today that you enjoyed the sessions and the tours. How many people got to go on a tour today? Raise your hand if you're on a tour. All right. Is it still snowing out?
No.
I haven't seen outside since 7 o'clock this morning. Welcome all. We're here for the leadership conference. A special welcome to the folks who joined us from the D.C. area for just this event tonight, and you'll be invited tomorrow evening as well. Special welcome to those folks who are here. So I haven't given a very strict script to follow, make sure I say the right thing, so I'm going to do my best. Tonight promises to be one of the most amazing discussions you're likely to hear. No pressure. For those of you who don't know, I should introduce myself. My name is Chris Marshall, I'm the Associate Vice President for Alumni Affairs. Again, welcome, but ready for this amazing discussion you're likely to hear, most amazing discussion you're likely to hear. A discussion which will illuminate the key factor that makes Cornell one of the top universities in the country. That is our focus on our faculty's commitment to teaching and mentoring. Your research, lots of things, but teaching and mentoring is the key focus for tonight and how it impacts the You Changed My Life. Our moderator tonight, who will be introducing our panel and will facilitate the rest of the discussion, is Lance Collins. In addition to holding a faculty appointment in mechanical and aerospace engineering, since July 1st, we've started to call him Dean. He is the Joseph Silver Dean of Engineering. Dean Collins will be joining us, or is with us tonight, I should say, as our moderator. He's been with Cornell since 2002 and has been widely recognized as a leader within his college and beyond, and having played a key role, a major role, on President Skorin's Strategic Planning Advisory Council, which will guide the university to 2015, our centennial, and beyond. Prior to coming to Cornell, Dean Collins taught at Penn State, the French National Research Laboratory, and the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Please join me in welcoming Lance, who will introduce our panel and moderate our discussion. I'll join you at the end for wrap-up. Lance, Dean Collins, it's all yours. Thank you.
Thank you all, and welcome to You Changed My Life. I can say that as dean, one of the great pleasures I have is meeting lots and lots of alumni. And those interactions always talk about the incredible connections that they have with specific faculty that mentored them when they were students. And so in a sense, this session is a celebration of those relationships, the relationships between faculty and their students. And the way we're going to do that celebration is to highlight two of those relationships right here with my panelists. So let me introduce the panel. Dick Polenberg is the Marie Underhill Knoll Professor of History. This is Dick right here. And I'm going to give... So this is really a sort of brief introduction, but I'll give a longer a description of their backgrounds in a moment. I have David Goldston, who's class of 1978, which is one of Dick's students. He's Director of Government Affairs for the Natural Resource Defense Council. Mary Lane Vandermeulen, who is the John Swanson Professor of Biomedical Engineering in the Sibley School of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering. And Jocelyn Beach, who's class of 2004, her student, fourth-year medical student at Cleveland Clinic, Lerner College of Medicine, a five-year program with Case Western Reserve designed to train clinician scientists. Many alumni remember their Cornell experience as a pathway to self-discovery, growth, and broadened horizons. Faculty members serve as their teachers, mentors, friends, and guides through this grand transformation. No wonder, then, that Cornell alumni seek to reconnect with those faculty members who provide a direct link to their past and who played a role in who they are today. Tonight, we will have the rare experience of hearing about two such faculty-alumni relationships firsthand. They are very different relationships, yet they exemplify both the ties that bind our alumni more strongly to their alma mater and how a faculty member's interest in his or her student as a person, scholar, and professional enriches both parties as well as the university. So now let me introduce the first pair of friends and colleagues. Dick Polenberg earned his PhD in history at Columbia University in 1964 and joined the Cornell History Department 2 years later. He is a specialist in modern American history and constitutional history. the author of many books, edited volumes, and articles. He won the American Bar Association's Silver Gavel Award for his study of the Abrams case, the Supreme Court, and free speech. He has received two awards for outstanding teaching, the Clark Distinguished Teaching Award and the Stephen H. Weiss Presidential Fellowship. For those who don't know, that's the highest award we have at Cornell. The recipient of a Fulbright Fellowship, which enabled him to spend a year teaching at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, Dick now holds the Marie Underhill Knoll Chair in History. In his spare time, Dick hosts a web-based radio show on folk music and the blues called Key to the Highway. And as an aficionado of American folk music, he has had the distinction of jamming with Pete Seeger and Peter Yarrow, which is not bad. So Dick's, the student relationship on the other side is David Golston. He's the class of 1978. He's the director of the Government Affairs for the Natural Resources Defense Council, Civilian Research Activities of the Department of Energy, and the Environmental Protection Agency, working on environmental issues in Congress. David has also taught at Princeton and Harvard, you know, sort of lesser Ivy League schools that out there, and has written the monthly column, Party of One, on science policy for the journal Nature. David was graduated magna cum laude with a BA in American History from Cornell in 1978. He completed the coursework for a PhD in American History at the University of Pennsylvania in 1993. So my questions will first be to Dick, and he's asked me to, so I'm gonna give three questions and then he will respond. Dick, during the 45 years you've been at the university, you have been an exceptional teacher, advisor, and mentor to a generation of students. What do you feel you've done to become an effective teacher? That's question one. What goals have you set for yourself, and what have you learned along the way? Question two. And how did you meet David, and how did your relationship take on a new dimension after his graduation?
Okay. Thanks very much. The introduction. Can you all hear me okay? How about now? Now? Okay, well, when I was invited to speak at this gathering, I have to admit I was a little concerned about what I might say that would be of interest to all of you. But over the years, you know, whenever I worry about things like this, I think of a story told by Harry Hopkins, Franklin Roosevelt's Minister of Relief, who headed the WPA back in the 1930s. Hopkins told the story of a girl who was about to go on her first date, and she asked her father what she might expect. "Well, daughter," he said, "this young fellow is very apt to hold your hand, and daughter, that is all right. And then he'll want to put his arm around you, and that's all right. Then he'll want you to put your head on his shoulder, but you must not do that because your mother will worry." Well, the next morning, her father asked how the evening had gone, and she said, "Well, Dad, everything happened just as you said it would. He held my hand, then he put his arm around me, then he wanted me to put my head on his shoulder, but I said, hell no, you put your head on my shoulder and let your mother worry." So I decided not to worry. What's the point in worrying? Simply, rather, to talk about some of the aspects of teaching that I've done in the 45 years that I've been on the Cornell faculty, how I've approached teaching, what I've tried to accomplish, and what's given me the greatest satisfaction. I was very lucky in 1966 when I joined the history department because the chairman then was Frederick George Marcham, a man with an extraordinary devotion to undergraduate teaching. Fred was born in 1898. He fought in the British Army during World War I. Come to Cornell as a graduate student in 1923. He was a colleague for many years, of course, for Carl Becker. And he joined and he continued to teach long after his supposed retirement. Indeed, Fred taught until he was well into his 90s. He was a specialist in British constitutional history, but his true specialty was the art of teaching young people, encouraging their interest in history, drawing them out, building their self-confidence, and showing them how a good real education could help them lead richer and more satisfying lives. For many years, our offices were next to each other, and the brief talks I'd have with him in the morning, before or after we taught, about what we'd done in class that had worked well, and sometimes about the mistakes we made were, I realize now, in fact I even realized it then, were some of the most meaningful discussions I've ever had with any colleague. One shortly after I began teaching at Cornell, I came back from lecture to hold office hours, and I found a young woman sitting, waiting outside my door, sitting on the floor. That's what students used to do. They used to sit and wait in order to talk to you. Now they send you an email, and you never get to see students sitting outside offices anymore. Anyway, she came in, and I asked, what could I do for her? I thought there'd be a question about something I'd said in lecture, maybe about an upcoming prelim or about some other courses in the department that I might recommend. Instead, she said she was a student in the engineering school, and she said, Professor, you think history is really neat. Can you tell me why? Well, you know, it was not a question I'd ever gotten before. I haven't gotten it since, and it certainly wasn't one I expected. But I remember, and maybe I remember her question even better than I remember the answer I gave to her, but I think I probably should have said, would have said, and did say something like this. I think history is neat because the problems that human beings have faced in the past are essentially the same problems that we face now. So seeing how people went about dealing with those problems, sometimes successfully, sometimes not successfully, helps us understand how we might deal with them today. The problems, broadly stated, are those Americans always have and always will face. The problem of justice, the problem of equality, the problem of freedom, how to define, how to defend, and how to develop them. Now those problems naturally assume different forms in different eras, but the problems themselves don't change that much. Reinhold Niebuhr once said, quite truly, quite correctly, that democracy is a means of finding proximate solutions to insoluble problems. So my approach to teaching lecture courses was to emphasize cases or situations that address those broad problems. I quickly learned that if I really cared about a topic, if it moved me emotionally or intrigued me intellectually, it would be an easy matter to convey my enthusiasm to the class. But if I didn't, I probably couldn't hide my own indifference. And what I cared about the most, it turned out, were people, the human beings who are the stuff of history, and not impersonal forces or broad trends or large-scale developments. And those people, the ones I spoke about, were as likely to be outsiders, victims, or the powerless, as they were to be insiders, victors, or the high and mighty. Consequently, students who took my classes would hear a lot about the Sacco and Vanzetti case, but not much, nothing in fact, about the Smoot-Hawley tariff. They'd hear a lot about Japanese-American internment during World War II, but not much about the War Production Board. A lot about J. Robert Oppenheimer, but nothing at all, I guess I have to confess, about the Bricker Amendment. I told myself that students could always read on their own about the topics I neglected if they were of a mind to, but that my role was to let students see how much the past meant to me, how deeply I cared about it, how specific historical cases provided insight into the larger problems that we face as citizens. Many books could be written about allegedly important subjects that I never mentioned in my lectures. In fact, those books have been written. I haven't gotten around to reading them, but I'm sure other people have. My goal in teaching seminars, of course, was somewhat different. Simply put, it was to have students feel comfortable speaking in class. I'd usually begin by asking how many students had ever felt nervous or even frightened about participating in a discussion. Invariably, virtually every student in the class would raise his or her hand. And when I asked why, the answer was that they were afraid of saying something wrong or something silly or maybe getting a bad grade because of that. So I made a promise, and the promise was that nothing that anyone said in class would have any effect on their grades. I mean, the papers that they wrote would determine their grades, but they could say whatever they wanted. And since we all have and had and will have wrong ideas, the only way to free our minds of them is to get them out on the table and find out they're wrong and then we don't have them anymore. I also encourage students to disagree with me on controversial issues, on the understanding they were entitled to have their own views and that I wouldn't feel hurt or insulted if they didn't see things my way. And finally, I encourage students to learn from each other, especially by writing comments on the first drafts of their classmates' term papers. The goal was for everyone to help everyone else do the best possible job. I've always thought that cooperation in the interest of scholarship was far better than cutthroat competition for grades. So it seems to me that the most meaningful learning takes place when students learn what they want to learn, not what they have to learn. Seminars provide a good opportunity, in fact, a perfect opportunity to put this into practice. I've told students that they should start reading the assignment, the day's assignment, but if they came across a subject that intrigued them on the second page or on the fifth page or wherever, just put down the assignment, go to the library, or nowadays the internet, and find out all that they could about the subject that they really cared about. I then invite them to tell the class what they discovered. My theory is that a student who learns something this way doesn't ever forget it. If you learn something because you have to learn it, because you're going to be tested on it 2 weeks later, it's very easy to forget it the week after the test is given. But if you learn something because it means something to you and you want to learn it, then you always have it. And looking back on a half century of teaching, nearly all of it at Cornell, I can say honestly that one of the things that's given me the most satisfaction has been the opportunity to remain in touch with former students. Many of them have gone on to do very highly important work in the fields of education and scholarship, journalism and law, medicine and government service. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is when these men and women, now in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, their 50s, some of them even in their 60s, want to remain in touch, sometimes by phone, often by email, best of all, of course, in person. And it's also been a real treat, in some instances, to teach their children. My colleague Fred Marcham ended up teaching the grandchildren of his first students. I'm not going to get to that point, but the children are always a great pleasure to teach. One of those former students, whom I first taught more than 35 years ago in a freshman writing seminar, is David Goldston. The topic was civil liberties in the United States, and I seem to recall that before taking the class, David and a friend of his came to see me to ask what I planned to teach and how I planned to teach it. I had the distinct impression that I was the one being interviewed. And I guess somehow I passed because they both took the class. And since that time, David's become a trusted and valued friend. And when he's back in Ithaca, we've talked and we've played Frisbee, and we've talked and we've played catch. We've talked and we've played the guitar and sang. And we've talked and we've talked and we've talked. And over the years, I think I've done less of the talking and David's done more. That's because he's doing a lot of interesting things these days, and it gives me a great pleasure to be here on the panel today with him. Thank you very much.
Sort of the private conversation before the panel began, Dick mentioned some interesting tidbits. One is he estimated the total number of students that he has instructed, it's something on the order of 20,000. I'm curious, just to, by a show of hands, how many in the room have had him in classes? So there's a bit of your legacy. The other interesting comment, I can't let go the statement you made about democracy, because I would then say there must be a close connection between democracy and engineering, because in engineering we try to find approximate solutions to intractable problems as well. So there's I don't know what to make of that, but in any case, it's just kind of an interesting thing to me. So I guess now we turn to David Goldston, who had this long-standing relationship with Dick, and I just wanted you to start by maybe talking a little bit about how it all got started.
Sure. My favorite comment about democracy, which is one from the E. White essay where he said, and you don't want this to be true of engineering. Democracy is nothing more than the recurrent suspicion that more than half of the people are right more than half of the time. My bio, a couple of different things got enlightened there. So actually, I worked for about 20 years on Capitol Hill, the last six as chief of staff of the House Science Committee, and then did the teaching, and more recently, in the last year, been working for NRDC, which is an environmental organization. So I was thinking, Dick got sort of more more soft and easygoing as the years went on. I don't remember this raising our hand if we had been afraid of speaking business. I do remember the looking at each other's papers, which is actually for some people more terrifying than public speaking. I'll just say a couple of quick things to start and then get to the dean's question about how we first met, which Dick already alluded to. So one of my stories about what it's like to be in college comes from being, so this seminar was second semester of freshman year, and I'd written a paper on, I don't remember what, one of the Civil Liberties books, it might have been, on one of the Civil Liberties books, and the comment came back that it was a good paper, but the tone was a little too hortatory, which I then had to look up. And I thought, this is college. You have to look up the way you're being criticized. So being working now for an advocacy group, it's sort of my job to be too auditory, so I'm not sure the criticism stuff. But so in terms of how we met, it was, as Dick said, that those days, I don't know if they still do this, for freshman seminars. First of all, faculty taught freshman seminars, which was extremely helpful. You had to get the permission of the instructor to get in, so you were required to talk to the instructor in advance. I'm not sure what the screen was, whether it was really first come, first serve, or who was actually had the bravery to come talk to the instructor. But we did have this discussion where actually the person with me, who later became a journalist, did this sort of interviewing Dick, and I sort of sat there thinking, this is interesting. But we did both go in. Dick did a lot to make sure that the class really cohered, and so we had at least one seminar over at his house in the evening, for example, and we became enough of a group, I assume you did this with other classes too, but made you feel special at the time, that our senior year, senior week, which most people are not thinking of as the height of their academic experience, Dick nonetheless had us over for our group for a seminar. We had a reading for it. It was actually on issues on civil liberties from the Nazis marching in Skokie, Illinois, which was a current topic at the time. And everybody showed up. No one thought, why am I going to a seminar during senior week? We jumped at the chance and had that one last time together. And then my first job after college was in upstate New York. I came back to Ithaca frequently. I think actually it sort of became almost this biological thing, whereas every like third weekend each for the first year I was out, and would stop by Dick's house, and that became the standard, and we gradually became closer and closer friends. Now it tends to be more like once a year, but I always make sure to stop by. We did try at one point to actually make it where I would tell them I was coming by and make an appointment. And the one time we actually did that was the only visit where we never ended up meeting, so I thought, forget it, they can just send me away if they want to. You know, I was well enough known by that point. So you had more questions.
So in the interest of full disclosure, I have the sense that David was a few minutes late in terms of our sort of prearranged meeting, and Dick was commenting that don't worry, this is kind of a commonplace. So I guess your approach, your extemporaneous approach, is it working?
I actually sent an email saying I was going to be late, but it would have been assumed anyway.
Any comments about his teaching style and how that his approach to teaching and how that stimulated you? Or
well, I think again in the seminar. There was this real sense of openness in trying to really get the students to talk. I think there would be, you would make some introductory comments, and then it really was a discussion. And as someone who's since led seminars, I mean, keeping a seminar going without making clear that you're intruding and guiding it is one of the most amazing skills a person could have. So, and Dick was always able to do that, so we learned from that. I think there was this sense of putting us at ease, even if not through the particular way that he used later, perhaps. But I remember, for example, one time, it must have been mid-semester, each person started his or her comment by saying, I didn't get to finish the book, but. And Dick Fine said, It's fine. Let's just assume no one finished the book and just go to the actual comments. So so I think that was important. I think getting us to really consider questions, getting us to consider different sides of issues, just the arrangement of the course and the range of issues that we were dealing with, which were all fairly new to me. I mean, I knew about the trial in Sacco and Vanzetti, and I knew about Japanese internment, but certainly I never read about them in any depth. I remember actually we read the Walker Commission, which is the report on the Chicago Convention riot, which I actually still remember because I had never read anything with so much hatred seething from the pages of what I was reading. It really sort of stuck with me. And so there was that, and then in Dick's lecture, which I actually sat in on, audited, never actually took, the openness, the ability to engage people, and the Cornell History Department style, which Dick helped, was emblematic of, which was not speaking from notes, you know, coming in, writing an outline on the board, and then just talking, was something that I think really stuck with me when I was a TA, while I was a grad student, and gave lectures that wasn't the style at Penn, and I always did that. I would, you know, because that was what I thought really worked, and was sort of what I had grown up with. So those were some of the elements that I think left a lasting impression.
So as the last question, is there any specific piece of advice that you can think of that you got from Dick that influenced you or your career?
I don't know if there was any specific piece of advice, although as it said, comments on individual papers. But no, I think the whole general way of his approach to things, I mean, there was this, I mean, I think I was interested in public service anyway, but I mean, the importance of government, the importance of public service, the interest in people who otherwise might be lost, as he was talking about, whose stories might be lost. But also, and his exactitude. I mean, Dick was in a very friendly way, you know, a demanding professor, which I think, well, certainly the demanding part I've gotten, hopefully the friendly part too, but so that the papers were really read very closely, and if there was something that was argued sloppily, it was not just taken in passing, you were called on it, and that was really getting that kind of training in thinking things through with precision, I think, was as important as everything else.
Great. Thank you. So now we're going to turn to our other pair. By the way, there'll be a time for questions at the end, so you'll have a chance to ask questions to everybody. So let me introduce Mary Lane Vandermeulen. She is professor in the Sibley School of Mechanical Aerospace Engineering. She's, as I mentioned, the Swanson professor. Her research in orthopedic biomechanics focuses on the interaction between mechanical stimuli and the skeleton. Among her many distinctions, she has received a National Institutes of Health First Award and a National Science Foundation Faculty Early Career Development Award. Mary Lane was featured in the 2006 book, Changing Our World, True Stories of Women Engineers, and is a member of the CU Advance Team, a project funded by a five-year NSF grant to increase the recruitment, retention, and promotion into leadership positions of women in engineering and the sciences. Her student is Jocelyn Beach. Jocelyn is originally from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, was graduated from the College of Engineering in 2004. While at Cornell, where she was a biological engineering major, and in addition to doing research with Mary Lane, she also played varsity soccer. After graduating, Jocelyn worked for 3 years as a research engineer at the Hospital for Special Surgery in New York City, where she was able to continue working with Mary Lane on biomechanics research. Jocelyn is currently a fourth-year medical student in this five-year program at Cleveland Clinic. She is spending a year doing outcomes research, studying cardiac surgery patients who receive valve replacements. So, Mary Lane.
Yes.
This is my former colleague, too. To begin with, why don't you tell us a little about your career, your lab, and how you get into engineer, how you integrate engineering and the basic sciences.
So I arrived at Cornell in 1996, and I came via the two coasts. I'm an immigrant. I was born in the Netherlands, and we came here early in my life because my father had a postdoc in the U.S., and I think my parents thought they would go back, but never went back. And so I was raised with a little bit of, it's not, I guess, you know, there's been all this stuff in the news about the Asian mothers, but European parents have their own dominant characteristics. So at some point, so it was clear that I had to have a career to make a living. And at some point, I wanted to be a marine biologist. I think that was around ninth grade. But I was told that I could not earn a living doing that and that I should maybe consider engineering. So that's how I became an engineer. And I also, my college choice process was the first experience for my parents as well with this process. So it went very differently for me than for my sister, who then had an informed set of parents. And I was kind of like rushed for MIT within my own household. And I remember actually when I decided I was going to go to MIT, my sister burst out in tears because she gets the computer. And like I had gotten all these things promised to me as bribes for if I went to MIT, because I think that was sort of my father's dream. So I went to MIT, and I knew at that point that I wanted to do something with biomechanics because I had seen something, a piece on 60 Minutes, and actually it turned out later it was probably a hoax, but it was something with Jerry Petrovsky at, I think it was Wayne State or Wright State, and I apologize because I know those are very distinct institutions, but this was a long time ago, and it was about functional electrical stimulation helping people walk. And so it wasn't marine biology, but it seemed like I could combine engineering with life sciences in a way that I found appealing, and so that I could still get the biology in. And so when I looked at schools, I looked at doing something bioengineering from the start, and I ended up in mechanical engineering because one of the faculty I met when I visited there said, you know, this is a great broad area and you can do anything, and we do a lot of things that incorporate biology. So that's how I ended up with an interest in, I ended up in mechanical engineering with an interest in doing something biological from sort of day one that I went to college. And I think if you look at my essays, I shudder what they say, but they probably say something about that. So I enjoyed 4 years. I had a really nice time, a lot of fun. And then came time to look for a job. The economy wasn't doing so well, and people said, you really should look at grad school. And I was out interviewing, with Lawrence Livermore, and I think I also interviewed with JPL. And so I was in the California swing of interviews, and then I went to visit some California grad schools. And I saw Palm Drive, and I thought, oh my god, palm trees. Why did I know about this 4 years ago? And off I went to grad school in California, in Palo Alto. So, and again, I had a good time there, got involved in research in orthopedic biomechanics, and that's what I continue to do today. It was also a nice place to be climate-wise and activity-wise. I played a lot of volleyball at lunch and things like that, so it was really a very pleasant experience. And I then stayed and worked at the VA Medical Center in Palo Alto for a couple years after that, and at some point was approached by Cornell if I wanted to interview, and I actually declined. I wasn't looking for a job, and then one of my office mates interviewed, and they said, you know, you should really think about they asked me about you during my interview, maybe you should call them. So I called them, and actually, if you go back to my lab notebook from that day, literally, I'm a real lab notebook keeper, and there's a little bulleted list of the reasons I didn't apply to Cornell, well, I didn't apply for the job at Cornell. And so I called and I explained them, and then they said, the chair of the search said, I really haven't heard anything that keeps you from applying, why don't you send me your CV? And at some point, I did interview, and I guess I do much better in situations where I have nothing to lose, and I felt like I had a job, I wasn't looking for a job, I actually couldn't leave for another year, so this was sort of an interesting exercise. And I remember being in Europe visiting a lab like 2 weeks later after my interview and saying, I think I have a decision to make, I'm sort of surprisingly, and that's how I ended up at Cornell. But at the time, it was a really tough decision, but when you look at this at the coast, and I'm really sort of an East Coast person, I talk quickly, I like the pace on the East Coast, it's a little different than the West Coast. I started making a list of all the schools that were options on the East Coast, and there's a lot of places I didn't want to be. I can tell you all the places that are not that I don't want to list, and Cornell ended up very high once you start thinking about the positives. So that's how I ended up at Cornell. And one of the things that I think is fantastic about Cornell, and this is how we get relationships like the one that I have with Jocelyn, is our undergrads, and that's most of you in this audience, are fantastic. And as a researcher who needs personnel in the lab and who needs to work closely with students, we're really, really fortunate. And it's really fun, and it's a great part of our job. And so that's why I'm sitting up here now, because of that type of relationship, and that's something that Cornell offers in ways that other institutions don't. When I was a grad student at Stanford, you'd talk to undergraduates, might come by because they want to do research, and then you wouldn't hear from them ever again. And Cornell students want to be in the lab, they're persistent, and they don't really take no for an answer in ways that are fascinating sometimes. But it's really fun, and it's a wonderful part of the job. So that's how I ended up at Cornell and in my career.
Thank you. So can you say a little bit about how you approach mentoring your students? Do you have anything about sort of your philosophical approach to that?
So I do better in one-on-one situations, I think, and so I like interacting with students in the lab in one-on-one, and I also like students with whom I can have a somewhat longer-term relationship. So students that come to see me my senior year, their senior year, it's not as interesting to me because we don't get to develop them as much as a researcher and as an individual, you know, as you do when you start interacting with someone earlier on. And also, I think for them, it's a better experience because, in my lab at least, you start on less interesting things because you don't have as many skills. But then, if you're in the lab for more than 1 year, the lure that I give people is, well, the first year I tell you what you're doing, and you don't have enough knowledge to decide on anything. But then in subsequent years, you get more and more input into the process, and hopefully, in your senior year, if you start as a junior or you start as a sophomore, you'll be interested in doing your own project, and you'll know enough, and you'll have been in the lab, and you'll have seen how things work, so that you get to choose, and you get to tell me what would be interesting. And yeah, you know, we'll iterate on it and stuff, but it's much more fun, I think, for the student to have something where they're more engaged and where they get to, and they're in your office in the first place because they're interested in what you do, but it's much more interesting if you then get to help set that direction. So that's one thing. Another thing is really for mentoring, and so I guess I'm talking more about the lab than the classroom, is being integrated in my research group is a really important component. I think if I give you a task to do and you have a project and you work in isolation, you get no sense of the big picture and how these things fit in, and I think that's really important to what we do, especially in the life sciences. You know, much of what I do is motivated by human health, but yet when you're writing computer code to analyze images, you're not thinking that this image in some way relates back to osteoporosis, for example. So I think it's really important to be part of the bigger picture and to see what my other students do, what the other undergrads are doing, what the grad students are doing, and what how the pieces fit together, and that's a really important piece to me as well.
There's an interesting commonality that I just noticed as you were responding about this sort of empowerment of the student. So the student can push back and express their opinions, disagree with me. That's okay. You were talking about as you nurture them along, they begin to have their own opinions and so forth. I don't know. Maybe there's just something about that we might discuss at some point. I don't know if anybody has a comment to make about that, but I. Just as I'm listening to all of the comments, that seems to be a thread, which I think is a very nice thread, and not true everywhere, I should add. So you talk about the lab, and I just, so there's a statistic you gave me, which is actually, I think, pretty amazing, that you think you've supervised something like 50-plus undergraduate students in your laboratory, which is really a remarkable number. And I guess, can you just say anything else about that experience and then something about where those students have gone on in their careers?
Yeah, so I had my CV and I had the count, but I left it upstairs. But I think I've had 52 undergrads in my lab over the years.
I'm going to check that number, by the way.
Yeah, I will too. I'll send an email. I think about a third of them have gone on to grad school, and again, that's, I think, a unique feature of Cornell compared to many of our peer institutions, that so many of you do continue on, and that's why you're interested as an undergrad in being in the lab in the first place. And I think I said a third, and then Jocelyn sort of challenged me on this, so I'm going to say a quarter to a third.
Empowerment of the student, remember?
I think a quarter to a third have gone on to medical school, or I'd say one or two have gone to law school, one or two have gone to vet school. So there's, you know, sort of life science type school, but so there's quite a few that have gone on to medical school as well, and then there's a fraction that have gone straight into the workforce as well. But I think I've mentored quite a few, more than 10 senior theses that have all been projects in the lab, I think. And then I've also had quite a few NSF fellows that have come out of those undergrad students that are students that have continued on to graduate school. And I think that, again, is a feature that where Cornell ranks very highly, and the quality of our undergraduates allows that you to do so well in those types of honors, I think, as well, also.
Yeah, we actually really, yeah, the ranking highly. We do have a lot of our students that go on into other universities and into academic careers and so forth at a disproportionate rate to our size. It's sort of a tradition. It really speaks to the dedication. This is hard work. You know, this is one-on-one kind of mentoring. So having that large number of students is really impressive.
Can I give one trivia point on that?
Sure.
So I guess as part of Advance that I haven't talked about, but I'm doing a panel on tomorrow, which I'd like to put a plug in for. As part of the Advance program, we looked at these statistics, and actually in engineering, Cornell undergraduate is the number two, was ranked number two in the country producing women faculty in engineering that received their undergraduate degree at Cornell University. So I think that's a fantastic statistic, and again, it speaks to the quality of our undergrad population.
So as your final question, I just wanted you to talk to your relation about your relationship with Jocelyn, qualities that you see in her, and what you tried to nurture in her.
So poor Jocelyn, I actually save all my email, much of my email. When I was a director of grad studies, I had some problems that required old email, so I went back to my email. So I think we met because Jocelyn sent me email asking to work in the lab for the summer. It was her during her freshman year. And the reality is that freshmen have limited things in terms of coursework and background. And not to put anybody down, but you haven't had a lot of classes. And so you've actually barely had any engineering classes. But we often need what we call hands in the lab. And so there were actually two freshmen in the lab that year, Jocelyn and another student who just finished his PhD on the West Coast. And so I think we were just discussing, there were four students in the lab that year, and Jocelyn stayed active for the remainder of her Cornell career in my lab and did a senior thesis as well. So qualities initially were a person who was interested in the lab and who wanted to be there. And then as we went further in the relationship, I think, I should add one other note, which is our athletes at Cornell have superb time management skills. And so that's actually, if anyone can juggle being in a lab with classes and sports and other activities, because people have a variety of activities, it's the athletes at Cornell. And so, and actually Jocelyn was one of the first athletes I had in my lab, and so I sort of learned some of that through her, that those skills are fantastic. So what attracted me were those types of characteristics. And then over time, you know, it's clear that she was engaged, she liked what she was doing, and she contributed a lot to it. And I think, you know, she's now in a career that's going towards this direction in terms of becoming a doctor. So I think what we saw initially has borne itself out.
Thank you. So now I'd like to turn to Jocelyn. Jocelyn, what was your experience like as a female student in the College of Engineering?
So to be honest, I never really felt like a female student in the College of Engineering. I just felt like, you know, a regular, you know, 18-year-old who showed up, you know, at the hardest, you know, college at Cornell, ready to, you know, get my butt to work. You know, that being said, I think a lot of that has to do with Cornell in of itself. You know, Cornell's female to male ratio is probably, you know, the most equivalent, I think, than, you know, some of any of the engineering schools out there. And, you know, I never felt special. I never felt entitled to anything. You know, I just felt like anybody else that was there at Cornell. So, you know, being an engineering student in and of itself has, you know, special traits and, you know, distinctions to it. But at least being a female, I never felt, you know, different.
This is music to my ears, by the way. I mean, that was, you know, 20, 30 years ago, we were not making those kind of statements. We've come a long way. So how did you meet Mary Elaine, and what was your experience like working with her? And be honest and candid.
Yeah, no, of course. So, you know, I viewed myself personally a little bit higher than just a set of hands and a statistic about it, to be honest. You know, I thought I was, you know, this, you know, this dedicated student who's coming, you know, to work in the lab. I mean, but to be honest, I had an interest in research. I really wasn't quite sure what I was going to do with myself. I kind of ended up in the engineering school. I was the kind of kid who, you know, liked to create inventions to, you know, take care of chores and, you know, take things apart and that sort of thing. So engineering always seemed like a good fit, but I wasn't exactly sure what I was going to do at the end. Medicine had always intrigued me and sort of the human sciences. So I looked around for some labs to join. I think I actually wrote handwritten letter or typed letters and put them in people's mailboxes and then maybe emailed too.
Yeah, the email refers to it something earlier.
Yeah, so I actually contacted several labs and met with a handful of people and got a mixed bag of responses. Some of them were, well, you know, we could, you know, we've got some dishware that really needs to be washed. And then there was other ones that, you know, you could wash these mice and, you know, document every hour over 8 hours, you know, how many times they hit this, you know, ball. And, you know, as exciting as those seemed, when I went to Mary Lane, it was like this breath of fresh air. All of a sudden, you know, she's like, okay, we have this experiment and, you know, we're going to have these specimens and it relates to this. We're looking at, you know, these different proteins and bone matrix that we want to test to see the mechanical properties of. And I'm going to need you to come up with a way to test these. You're going to need to learn how to do that too, by the way. And we're going to do this summer. So all of a sudden, it just went from, you know, washing dishes to somebody actually wanting me to apply the skills that, you know, I was learning actually in the engineering school. So that was sort of how we originally met.
Mm-hmm. Did your relationship was it a formal mentoring, informal mentoring, and did it extend to your career as well?
Sure. I don't think we've ever really had much of a formal mentoring type experience. I mean, I think there are things that would happen occasionally, and you know, we would have sort of group dinners, you know, where we would try to, you know, like Mary Lane said, we all tried to know what other people were doing in the lab. And I think there were just sort of discussions kind of candidly as, you know, I was trying to sort of find my path. But I think for Mary Lane, a lot of sort of her mentoring was done by leading by example. You know, we all looked up to her, both literally and figuratively. By the way, an interesting statistic, if you want one, is most of her laboratory assistants, at least while I was there, were under 5'6", and Mary Lane towers over 6 feet. So she would actually keep all of the things that we sometimes need to find on the top shelves, and we would never be able to find them until she came into the lab. So, yeah, I mean, she was, you know, leading by example. You know, you can kind of get the gist of Mary Lane a little bit by, you know, needing to send an email about how many exact number of students and, you know, keeping rigorous notebooks. But, you know, those were kind of the traits that you sort of got brought up with. It was sort of the rigor of science, and I think that's something that I really gained an appreciation of. You know, to be diligent in your work, but also to, you know, treat it as with a lot of respect. And, you know, she has a great deal of scientific integrity, and I think a lot of those traits as I'm moving forward, whether I'm in medicine or, you know, go into research, you know, all those things sort of stay with me.
And has she influenced your career path as well?
So initially, I mentioned I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do, and I really had some unique experiences that we didn't really get to touch on too much, but, you know, working in her lab, she knew that I did have some interest in sort of the sciences, and maybe it was just the project that was available. I actually thought she maybe picked it for me, but since I was interested in medicine, I thought she had tied in a project that had some clinical significance and also had clinicians that were sort of interested in the project. So. For those of you who aren't aware, Hospital for Special Surgery is kind of one and the same with the biomechanics department at Cornell, and that's in New York City. It's a specialty orthopedic hospital, and Mary Lane, in part, has, you know, been a major contributor to make that relationship work. And so I was actually working with physicians at the Hospital for Special Surgery from basically my first summer that I was there. I then did two internships after that in the summer in New York, and working with additional people. And then after I graduated, I still wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. And I took a full-time position working there as a research engineer, kind of continuing to do some of the research that I, you know, started in college. Also basically getting full rein to come up with my own studies, to collaborate with residents and fellows, and tons of physicians, and some of the most rewarding work that I've, you know, done to date. that you know, I still, you know, think back and smile to. And you know, those relationships, you know, and working with clinicians, it just slowly began to help me realize that I wanted to, you know, do more medicine side and, you know, to be more involved in patient care directly. But that being said, you know, I'm currently in a program that's very much designed to sort of train physician scientists and to get clinicians to be more engaged into research and to sort of bridge the gap between clinical science, clinical medicine, and the basic sciences. And, you know, I think all of that probably wouldn't have happened, you know, had I not gone in this lab and had these relationships. So, and, you know, and my goal in sort of moving forward as I'm, you know, moving into residency, you know, I'll probably end up, you know, in an academic type of path as well, you know, which I think all of this nurturing has sort of fostered.
You know, as you were talking about the Mary Lane's height, so she's well over 6 feet. It reminded me that we have, there's some video footage out there. The senior students in mechanical and aerospace engineering have a tradition of making a video. It's a campy thing, you know, they're trying to poke fun at faculty and so forth. And so that particular year, they decided to have a one-on-one with Mary Lane. And so there's some pretty embarrassing footage out there with me getting stuffed by her. So Jocelyn, your last question: how has your relationship evolved, and how do you work to sustain it?
Sure. I mean, I think our relationship has definitely evolved. And I mean, we've known each other about 10 years now, which is very brief compared to our counterparts here. But you know, I think initially very formal. It was a very formal relationship at the beginning. I think many of us, maybe it's the stature thing, or we're slightly intimidated by Mary Lane, and you know, she's just so rigorous with her work, but. At the end of the day, she's very hands-on and really wants us to pursue our own work. And you know, much of kind of the themes that have sort of come out here is that you know, it's just you have a project and she lets you go forward with it. But if you need help, you can kind of step away, and it's always there. You know, you're going to get some criticism, but it's always constructive, and you know, it's always with the intent to sort of foster you forward. And you know, so I think initially it was very structured, and as I moved on to Hospital for Special Surgery. Mary Lane still played a huge role in my projects, but it was much more sort of a guidance. You know, she would make sure that I, you know, got to present at meetings on projects I was involved in. You know, she helped me learn how to write manuscripts better. It was much more of a sort of higher level mentoring type thing. And we also became friends. You know, we would go out to dinner. My husband is from Ithaca and also a Cornellian, so I had the excuse of getting back quite often. And maybe it's a mentee-mentor thing too, but I never call until I'm in downtown.
3 minutes away.
So I thought it was my age, but so you know, and now you know we get to see each other several times a year, which is you know really fun. And you know, I actually we have a year of research built in my program, and there's a student a year below me who was interested in orthopedics, and I've actually sent him to contact Mary Lane and. Some of the physicians that I work with there. So I think in some ways, you know, sort of perpetuating the trend and, you know, giving other students the opportunity to have such valuable experiences. I think.
Okay, thank you, Jocelyn. So I'd like to invite the audience to ask questions. So there are some mics that are freestanding or can be passed around if you have questions. Just please raise your hand. Okay, you're not going to be able to leave until there's a question. Thank you.
Thank you all. Jocelyn, I just want to say that you're a very impressive young person. You probably could have gone anywhere, and as a president of the Cornell Club of Northeast Ohio, we're very happy that you chose Cleveland to study in. We'd like to build an event around you this year, so we'll be talking, okay? To the professors, just kind of a general question. What are the students that bubble up, and what are the ones, if you look back historically, what are the ones that you've stayed in touch with? What are the characteristics or the traits that make those students stand out? Just a general question.
It's a very good question, but it's not an easy question to answer. I've taught so many students over the years and gotten to know many of them, but it's always it's always turned out that it's the student who takes the initiative in maintaining a relationship after graduation. It's very unusual that I would sort of begin that 2 or 3 years or any number of years after graduation. It sometimes happens if I'm going to be doing when I was doing research at various institutions or libraries. If I knew that a former student was at that institution, I would write and ask to get together and indicate that might be possible. But it's really usually the student who initiates it, and some students do and some students don't. And I must say that over the years there have been many students, a great many, who have wanted to stay in touch. I don't know quite why they want to, but they do, and it's a wonderful thing for me when students want to do that. It's always a great pleasure, and I'm fortunate that a significant number of students over all of these years and all of these classes have stayed in touch, have decided to get in touch when they come back to campus. Now, of course, students get in touch when their children are applying to Cornell. So I get to see them all over again, but now in a different context.
Mary Lane, did you?
So for me, it's mainly been students that I've had one-on-one relationships with, and that extends so students that work in my lab, and also I was, for example, the ASME, which is our professional organization, the American Society of Mechanical Engineers. I was the faculty advisor for that for 5 years. And so I worked fairly closely with the officers. We had to go to lots of regional conferences, and I was at an age at that point that I was sort of often had more in common with the students than I did with the other faculty advisors. There was a very large age, the age difference was less with the students than with the other faculty advisors often at these workshops that we had to go to. And it was a little weird for me sometimes, surreal. So anyway, those officers, a lot of those students I've kept in close contact with, and there's a bunch on the West Coast, and for a long time when I went out there, I would get together and have coffee or lunch with those students as well. So the initiative comes from them, but when I'm traveling and I know there's someone in the area that I've been in touch with a lot, then at that point I'll get on email and say, hey, you know, do you have time for a cup of coffee or something? So. But for me, it's mainly, it's fewer students out of big classes than it is from individual relationships and things.
Of course, that relative proximity and age changes over time. But
oh, yeah, no, that no longer exists.
Yes.
Both of our students have now had graduate training and relationships with faculty members as a graduate or a medical student. And I was wondering, could the students describe how their relationships as an undergraduate, you know, differs from the relationships they've had with mentors they've had in graduate school?
Sure. It's actually a really interesting point. So I'm currently doing a year of research working in a completely different field in cardiac surgery. And I think actually one of the things that I've gotten from this mentorship experience is how to choose a good mentor. And I think that's something that a lot of students have difficulty doing, identifying good mentors. But working with Mary Lane, working with a number of the clinicians that I worked with that I consider, you know, great mentors in my life, I've been able to sort of pick out those traits, and I currently have another set of phenomenal mentors, you know, that do almost some of the same exact things. You know, maybe it's the people as well, but, you know, they have a lot of the similar traits, this idea of giving you freedom to sort of search your own ideas, make mistakes, but then also if you need help, you know, they're there to support you. They're also the people who, and Mary Lane as well, and other people, that they'll kind of be there for your back. You know, when I'm looking for jobs or applying to residency, these people are there to support you along the way. They get you to meet with people, you know, that are within your field and to foster your own career. You know, they want you to make sure you're first author on the manuscripts. You know, they want to make sure that your career comes first. And I think that's something that I found in mentors that I currently have as well, and I hope in the future that, you know, to find more of them. So I don't know if it's just I've been lucky, but I think there's something to it.
I think part of it is there's just something about that undergraduate moment, the kind of intensity it has and the newness of everything that makes those early relationships in some ways stand out differently, and also that graduate school in a way is set up in a certain kind of mentor way where you really sort of have to find it yourself, undergrad. I mean, my experience was a little different in that I didn't go back to grad school until I was in my mid-30s, so there was this tension of, you know, are they the professor, are they my colleague, and so forth, which I didn't have when I was 18. In fact, the one comment some of my grad school college members, we were discussing a classic book of European history on the changing attitudes towards family that's called Centuries of Childhood, and I suggested it would be a great name, a great title for a grad student's biography. You didn't really have that kind of tension that you did as a graduate student, that I did as a graduate student. So, but I think it's just something about the feeling of being an undergraduate and not really knowing where you're going to end up, and switching from sort of a high school classroom where sort of everything was, where you had access and everything was presented to you, to a place where you just sort of make it on your own in a different way, that gives a certain kind of intensity and kind of poignancy to undergraduate relationships that are different from what you get in grad school.
The professors on the panel reflect the same kind of academic intensity that I experienced with my professors at tenureship. How does Cornell judge new faculty on whether they will get tenure based upon this love of Cornell's teaching? Is that part of the process?
Yes, it is. I'm not sure it's as much of a part of the process as it should be, but it's definitely part of the process. When the history department makes a tenure decision, the dossier, of course, includes the candidate's written work and assessments by scholars from other universities or reviews of that written work. But course evaluations are part of the dossier, all of the course evaluations that a teacher has accumulated. And in addition, the department writes letters to not every student that the teacher has had, can't do that, but sort of get a list of all of the students that the teacher has taught, and write to perhaps every third student or every second or fourth, depending on how many students there are. And we invite student comments, and those letters are part of the tenure dossier. Frankly speaking, the problem is that if a student has had a bad experience, or perhaps not a wonderful experience with a teacher, many students are reluctant to write about that. They feel, even if they didn't like the class, they don't want to say anything that might hurt the teacher's chances and staying on the job. And so unless it's really been an awful experience, usually students are overly kind, or the students who are not, don't feel very good about the teacher, just choose not to write. So the letters tend to be a little bit rosier than perhaps they should be, but we do what we can. An effort is always made, and if there's a situation where a teacher truly hasn't been effective, then that comes out, and then that will weigh heavily in the department's decision. Actually, what's happened in a number of cases, I'm glad to say, is that the same process happens at the third year review, and there have been a few situations where professors receive not very great student evaluations after the third year. The chair has spoken to the professor about it, and the professor has made changes, and by the time reviews come in at the time of the tenure decision, after 6 years, there's often a marked change. And so student evaluations, student opinions play an important role, I think, in helping teachers overcome whatever deficiencies there might have been and become even more effective teachers than they have been. So we do take it as seriously, I think, as we can. And I know that we take it more seriously than most other universities, certainly most other Ivy League universities. I've had former students who have gone on to become professors at major universities where their departments don't even want to know what students think about their teaching. All that matters is, quote, scholarship. That's never been the case at Cornell, and I'm sure it never will be.
Did you have anything?
I don't think I have anything to add to that. I think that reflects the process in my department in the College of Engineering as well. It's taken very seriously. And also, we run lots of workshops. I mean, we just had a week long before classes started, best practices in teaching workshop. I think it was university-wide, I'm not sure, but engineering, we spend a lot of time on this as well for new faculty, because we know that you're coming out of a research environment, you're often coming out of a postdoc, and it's not the thing you've been thinking about for all your waking hours, and now suddenly you're immersed in it, and so we spend some time, we definitely spend time on it.
I want to tell one story. When I heard, shortly after I came to Cornell, the department was interviewing a young man in American history, and my colleague Joel Silvey and I drove to the airport to pick him up, and we were then assistant professors, and this fellow was an assistant professor, you know, applying for an assistant professorship, and as we were driving back from Tompkins County Airport, I guess Joel was driving, I was sitting in the back, and he kind of turned halfway so he could speak to both of us, and he said in this kind of confidential manner, "So tell me, guys, just how little teaching do you have to do around here anyway?" And I looked in the rearview mirror, and Joel looked at me, we sort of caught each other's eyes, and we both were thinking the same thing. We might just as well make a U-turn, drive right back, and wait for the plane to leave, and not even do the interview. Well, as it turned out, we did the interview, we didn't hire him. He went on to become a chair professor at some other university and published all of these books, and I never regretted for one second that we hadn't hired somebody who had that attitude toward teaching. It's the very reverse of what all of us at Cornell in the history department, and I think in other departments too, have thought about the importance of undergraduate education.
So you spoke a little bit about the differences between, say, graduate mentoring and undergraduate relationships. In a place on a macro level, such as Cornell, with how do you create these relationships or support these relationships where students that may not be as ambitious to go or students that are in need of help or assistance or guidance, how do you make those relationships happen in that sort of environment?
That's a good question. I don't know. Kind of the whole panel can answer, really. Yep.
So, and that's a great question, and I don't know to what extent the university does that now. I mean, the key thing for me, although it still took some work, was that the history department, at least in those days, offered a lot of seminars. So you could end up just taking huge classes like VIX, which was like, what, 400, 600 in those days, probably had that bigger later. Or Site 101. Actually, this was always my example of people thinking in historic terms. I remember another Cornell History faculty member asked me once, "What's the largest class at Cornell?" And I said, "Site 101, it's about 1,100 people." And without thinking a moment, he said, "That's larger than most medieval towns." I thought, that's perspective. That and when one of my friends said they were doing a thesis on the 60s, and my first reaction was, which ones? I knew I had really absorbed historical perspective. But at any rate, there were all these, there were a lot of seminars available. You had to still make the effort to take the initiative to put your schedule together that way and not with the medieval town size courses. But it was at least available, and I think that was very important. There's also, maybe slightly against the grain, but there's it struck me from what Justin said too. There's an element of luck of timing, and whenever you're there, there'll be some good timing that will work out. But I remember Dick telling me once, years later, when we were talking about something about the department, he said, "You know, you were really there at the right time. Everybody, because there'd been a big bold of hiring in the late 60s, and basically everyone there, you know, had they gotten tenure, so we weren't so worried about that, but we were still kind of new and interested in really doing as much as possible, and so, you know, partly I was there at just that moment." And what you had said about, you know, being at that point where you weren't, you know, where you weren't sure whether you belonged with the students or the faculty, you know, that's a particular moment. So it's really sort of having, you know, your luck and interest sort of coincide partly with what's happening around you in that context. But to me, availability of small courses, and the other thing that I didn't mention that was so important in our relationship was Dick became my advisor, and the fact that you had to have a faculty advisor in the department and have someone who really actually spent some time talking to you and actually thought about it. Dick used to talk about how people would come in and kind of look down when they had the wine tasting on their schedule, which for better or worse, I never had, so I only heard about it secondhand. But the but his reaction is secondhand. But the but doing things that actually force their, especially in this internet age, that force some kind, that both allow in some cases and in other cases force interactions between student and faculty, I think are very important, because otherwise you really can get lost in a place that was then 16,000 students and now is 18,000.
I'll add, I guess, a little bit to that also. I think actually through faculty advising, and I think the current internet state of advising is actually very sad, because I just get emails, you know, will you approve this, and there's no discussion. So, and I like knowing, as I just said, after getting three of those emails from my new advisors, I just sent out an email explaining my philosophy in approving electives and how I want to hear your career goals and career intended career path and how they fit in them, so I don't just approve them. So we'll see if any of the email tone changes. But I expect it'll still be emails, unfortunately. Also, office hours. I like knowing the names of people in my class, and it's really hard because in a class you don't get to know that, but when they come to see you, and so I'm teaching, it's not a 400-person class, but I have a 36-person class right now. But whenever they come into office hours, I ask who they are, you know, what major are they, because I draw from multiple majors, and, you know, what, where are you going, what year, you know, so we discuss these things, and so I think that's an opportunity to engage people. And then the other thing are the social activities. So we have at the grad level with master students and PhD students, we have happy hours in our department, and I think it's really important the faculty go to those, because it debunks a little bit of the mystique around faculty. Ditto, the ASME kids have these faculty barbecues at lunch, and so again, a lot of faculty go to those, and it's some, for some students, it's the first time they've had a prolonged conversation with a faculty member that wasn't academic, and so I think they're really important. And then the Society of Women Engineers has been doing a lot in the College of Engineering to try to bring the women faculty to the women students. And again, there's various, they had a cupcake event that was actually pretty cool. But yeah, except that, you know, the other thing is I hate these doodle pools. They send out a doodle poll with like 50 options, and if there's more than five, I can't fill it out. I go nuts, and so I just couldn't respond to them this time. And I sent an apology saying, I'm sorry, you've saturated my doodle ability. But I think those types of things, I don't have time to go between the calendar and the doodle poll for all those little check boxes. It's crazy. So these informal social events, I think, play a really important role in debunking that faculty are people and that we can hold a conversation that's not a lecture, you know, and doesn't involve a formula in engineering and stuff. So I think those are really important. But again, there's also an onus on the students, because with advising, it's really painful because so many students come in and there's nothing interesting to take, and they, you know, what will I approve? Because they're just trying to sort of narrow things down, and that's not fun advising for me at all, you know. So there's also an onus on the student to take initiative and to do something, because otherwise, you know, we have like 25 advisees each, and so I have another 24 that someone might be more interesting, you know. So it's not like I'm going to spend hours drawing someone out either. But I think there's lots of opportunities if you want to make them happen, and office hours academically are a big one for me.
All right. I'd like to sort of add emphasis on the office hours, because my experience has been that students that are not performing that well often are a little sheepish to come in. They don't want to expose the fact that they're having problems. And they're often, whenever I can get them over that hurdle, they're often surprised to discover that the students that are at the very top of the class, who are the highest performers, are actually the ones that I see every week, you know, or multiple times a week. They're always in my office, and that's why they're the higher performers. There's a sense that, oh, well, they're natural, so they just get it, you know, first time around, and I really don't, you know, I'm not getting it, so I better not let that faculty member or even teaching assistant know about that. So it's kind of getting past that, you know, getting in and getting involved with the faculty. So this has really been a fantastic session. I want to thank all of the panelists, so Dick and David, Mary Elaine and Jocelyn. I have one thing. Is Lloyd Slaughter, class of 1956, here? He's not. That's it.
I was really looking forward to it. One more time, thanks to our panelists. We're going to wrap up. They promised to stay. next event is in the Salon 2, right behind this wall, our reception. Quick question to the group. How many people here went online and followed through with the Ripple Fly request that came in? Raise your hand. Ripple Fly. Ripple Fly is online.